but I passed the breath test. This is McDaniel Reynolds with the Reynolds Defense Firm, and we specialize in one thing. We represent good people facing DUI charges. While you know that it's illegal to drive with a .08 or greater blood alcohol content, not everyone knows that you could be arrested in Oregon for an alcohol DUI even if you blow well under a .08. This is a pretty loose standard, and it's a way that many of the good people we represent find themselves needing our help when they thought they were doing everything right. The Reynolds Defense Firm. We're solid, we're here if you need us, and we are very good at what we do.
BFFT. Now, built by High Caliber Millwrights, in for John Canzano, here's Jude and Newby and Stephen Vaughn with the Ball Faced Truth.
Welcome in, Boldface Truth, on a great Monday. Judah Newby, Stephen Vaughn in for John Cazano today. And you can join us always at 503-417-7575. So much to get to. What a weekend it was in sports. How about that finish for the Oregon Ducks?
Evans has been out there a long time. Lucas and Reynolds to hold, unless we have another timeout. From 39 yards for the win. Up and good. He got it. With 3 seconds left, it looks like Oregon is going to leave Iowa City with a huge victory.
Clutch. Tough stuff from the Ducks. Dan Lanning on watching Atticus Sappington at the end.
Well, if you want the truth, I was pretty nervous. Yeah, I mean, I'm nervous for him because it shouldn't come down to that moment for Atticus, and that guy's going to feel an unbelievable amount of pressure however that goes, but I'm really proud that he's able to handle a moment like that. We do a lot of pressure kicks in practice and try to recreate it, but there ain't nothing like 70,000 fans, right? Last second of the game, was it 7 seconds left, having to kick that kick? Can't recreate that in practice, and Atticus handled it like a champ.
I was not thrilled with Oregon's clock management on the final drive. But did they get some clutch moments? One, Dante Moore to Malik Benson. Hard to get prettier and more clutch than that. And the other, the 39 yada. Atticus getting it done. Special teams player of the week. The Oregon Ducks 18, the Iowa Hawkeyes 16. We'll unpack some of that. The reaction, the injuries. What the heck is going on in Eugene? Stephen Vaughn, is it something in the water? I thought that team was on bye week going into Iowa, not black and blue.
Yeah, that was the weird part is, right before the game, DeCorian Moore and Harkey and Kenny Sadiq all are out for injury. And no one really was expecting that going on. I think there's a couple of conspiracy theories that are going on.
We made it 2.5 minutes.
I said a couple. I mean only one that I can come up with, and that is that after that Indiana game, we all kind of critiqued Oregon again of being soft on the offensive and defensive line, right? Like, that was the one question. Like, can you go into Iowa? Can you be tough? Oregon proved that they can. But after the Indiana game, in that final drive in the fourth quarter where Surratt got the touchdown catch from Mendoza, it was, man, they got pushed around again. Dan Lanning goes into, you know, the bye week, goes into those practices and says, look, we got to be physical in practice now. We got to learn how to be physical. And they kind of beat each other up. And guys ended up actually getting hurt in practice because the practices were so physical. That's the only thought I can come up with is, like, they knew going into this game against Iowa, they were going to have to play big boy football. And they did that in practice, and they must have done that enough where they hurt some of their guys. It's the only thing I can think of. Because what other reason can it be to have all these guys go into the bye week and come out and be all injured going into a big-time ball game?
That I could understand maybe for the guys up front, like Harkey maybe.
Sadiq even.
Yeah, Sadiq, but I remember when he got that touchdown at Rutgers and he came up holding his midsection, and Dan Lanning, at least publicly, says it's a lot of that. Like, he wasn't up to full speed in practice because of the lingering stuff from the Rutgers game. DeCorian Moore, he said, was non-contact injury during a little, routine workout for the practice, but it was non-contact. So, I don't know, it's probably a mix of raising the physicality of practice and a little bit of bad luck, and probably just precautionary stuff because, look, let's be honest, like this November schedule, you had Iowa, you're going to beat Minnesota, you also had USC and Washington, but even if you lost this Iowa game, you would probably make it in with two losses if you ran the table.
I don't know about
that. Really? You didn't think 10-2 would make it in?
I don't think so this year. I think this year Looking at some of the schedules for some of these SEC schools and kind of how other conferences are playing out, I think 10-2 would have been a problem for Oregon. Like, you'd be right on the hot seat of making it. So I actually think that Oregon needs to run the table, even with this Iowa win. I don't think they can lose going out.
I think they have to run it probably now since Washington lost. If Washington had done what they were supposed to do, and I know it was a snowstorm and all that, but if they had beaten in Wisconsin, then I think the USC and Washington wins at the end of November, if Oregon were able to get that done, would be good enough with two losses to make it in. But to your point, it's hardly a guarantee. And you might be right. It might be a 50-50 shot. I also think that, you know, part of me thinks the committee would put Oregon in for the brand recognition, like, and get them in for the ratings and television and all that. That's a team you would want to see go on the road in a first-round playoff game if they were a borderline selection either way. But regardless, thankfully, they don't have to have that conversation, at least not yet. But the injuries are bizarre and wild. And Dante Moore, being as clutch as he was in the final minute of the game, was absolutely huge. So curious what you think. You can chime in at 503-417-7575. Does this Oregon team is currently constructed? Do they get it done against USC and Washington at the end of the month? Friday night, they host PJ Fleck in Minnesota. That should be a good game. Minnesota 6-3, 4-2 in conference. It's not like they are a pushover either. Getting a recent win over Jonathan Smith and Michigan State. Boy, Michigan State 0-6 in the Big Ten, Stephen. I mean, and they still got a couple of toss-up games in November. They got Penn State coming up as well. They've got Maryland. They better win a couple of those games, or else Jonathan Smith, he might be looking for a job this offseason.
I think Smith's out. I think the fan base has kind of had enough of him. You know, because when they hired him, they thought it was going to be, you know, a quick little resurrection there with Michigan State, and he was going to bring some of those Oregon State guys over. It hasn't even necessarily worked out. And now with the fact that, you know, more money may be coming into the Big Ten, we've seen some other coaches get fired. I don't think Michigan State wants to waste their time with Jonathan Smith and that, you know, with him and just that weird fit. But I do think if Jonathan Smith wants another job, he'll be able to get it somewhere. And then that team will be good, because I do think he is a good coach. But you're right, that, you know, that looks like it could be an 0-8 season in the Big Ten for Michigan State. I do want to ask you this, Judah, about that win for the Ducks down in Iowa. To me, that was Lanning's most impressive win so far as a head coach. I may not be the biggest, you know, it wasn't the biggest, you know, point spread. It wasn't, you know, they weren't underdogs. They were favored going into the game. But just seeing how that game played out, the weather that was going on, the crowd was absolutely insane. I thought the environment was tougher than the Penn State game. And for Oregon to go out and to get 261 rushing yards compared to 101 for Iowa, 7.3 yards per rush, I think that just showed, like, look, we are a physical football team. I don't know if it goes going forward, if it works all the way, but they answered some questions to me, and that is one of the biggest, that's the biggest win that Dan Lanning has had in his coaching career so far.
It's hard to argue, but I will argue it a little bit. And my biggest thing is the revisionist history that we have in college football and in the NFL as well. When we take big games in September, we treat them as big games, we treat them as big results in the moment, and because of the form another team takes in October and November, we go ahead and say, you know what, that September win wasn't as big. I don't agree with that at all, because there's a couple of things at play. One, Penn State, we know, is still a really, really talented team when healthy. The reason that Penn State collapsed, I think, was largely in part to Oregon ripping their hearts out in overtime. If Penn State wins that Oregon game, I don't think they collapse and fire James Franklin. That's how college football works. James Franklin, after that game, said, we are not going to let this Oregon loss define our season. Well, it did. I don't think Penn State folds in on itself like a dying star if they beat Oregon. But Oregon went in there and won that game in a crazy, crazy atmosphere, crazy game at the time. I'm not willing to go back and look at that end of September game for Oregon and say, you know what? Not an impressive win, because turns out Penn State sucks. I don't believe that. I don't believe that. I think Penn State died on itself because of that Oregon loss. They weren't going to collapse in and on themselves if they had beaten the Ducks in that game and if Drew Aller stayed healthy for the season. I don't necessarily know if they would have like made the playoff, but these kind of early shaping games do have an outsized impact with how we kind of look back at these teams. Like, I think the October Penn State we saw is a direct result of losing to Oregon at the end of September. If they win that game, I think Oregon probably looks different right now, and I definitely think Penn State looks different right now, and James Franklin's probably still coaching there if Drew Aller stays healthy in that game. But to your point, Stephen, this was an insane atmosphere, and a couple of things out of this game. The rushing yards, that's incredible. Are you kidding me? If you would have told me that Oregon would have rushed for, what was the final number?
261.
That's insane.
7.3 yards per rush.
That is insane. And Noah Whittington doing what he did, the two freshmen doing what they did. The O-line was awesome. Will Stein's rush scheme was awesome. Alik Terry's ability to get that line ready to go was awesome. Everybody was on point. They had different schemes. They had gap schemes. They had zone schemes. They had tough ass running in the low red zone with De'Aaron Hill punching that one into the end zone. They put on a clinic, and it's a much different type of Oregon rush attack than other iterations of Oregon running the ball that we saw with like LaMichael or Kenyon and even Royce and things like that. Like that spread rushing attack. This is power rushing football. Power rushing football on the road in the Big Ten for a new Big Ten school. Well, they don't win that game if they don't rush the football the way they did.
Does that change your thoughts, or does that prove anything from Oregon? Like, are they now, I mean, look, we already knew the national perception of them is not like they're this tough team. Like, they're still going to be the flashy Oregon Ducks. We know that they're kind of, they've changed that mentality. They are built through the offensive line, but we still have their questions about the offensive line, and can they push around big time Big Ten team? Does it change your mind? Like, are they now officially like a tough team on the offensive line? Well, I've really pushing people around.
See, I've always kind of thought that, you know, this I think reinforces that to me. The one blip was the Indiana game, to your point, which,
well, in the Penn State game in the fourth quarter and overtimes, they kind of got pushed around as well.
But that Penn State is freaking good up front. I don't know why, you know, people don't want to believe that Penn State has talent. They're incredibly talented, and you just said it. It's fourth quarter overtime on the road. Like, I'm willing to cede a couple of lost reps against a big physical team that constantly puts dudes in the pros, even though they're not having the season that they want. Like, I still do. How do you feel about the Penn State win at this moment? Like, is it still a zero? Because in the moment, we knew Penn State was a good team. We knew Oregon was a good team, and they went in there and got the overtime win and showed incredible toughness and resilience in doing it. Much in the same way we're talking about this Iowa win, I'm not willing to discount all of that just because Penn State decided to quit on the season. Like, they were quitting on the season September 30th.
It's not a zero, no, but it definitely has been downgraded from what it was. Like, after that win, you know, Oregon was being crowned as the best team in college football, and watch out for this team again. Dante Moore, you know, Heisman Trophy, number one overall pick. And I don't think that that's the way it should have been looked at, you know, hindsight being 2020.
And maybe it wasn't just the Penn State win, it's the Oregon loss to Indiana that looks at the Penn State win differently as well.
Right, and I think the combination of those two things have, you know, knocked Oregon back a little bit, but Oregon
deserves... Not to mention Indiana almost lost to Penn State.
Right, yeah, so, and Iowa too.
It's college football, people. Like, this stuff happens throughout a year, but we can't throw out entire victories and statement wins because the shape of a season ends up going differently than we thought it would for the team that lost that game.
I just think the Iowa win, man, that Iowa team is always going to be what they're always going to be. And Oregon out Iowa, Iowa. The special teams, yep. Iowa had the special teams blunder that turned it to a safety. Oregon's kicking game, Atticus Sappington. I remember right before, you know, the fourth quarter, like, oh, man, this game's going to come down to Sappington. Nobody seemed very confident in it that he was going to make that kick before he actually made the kick. He goes 3 for 3 from, you know, from field goals on Saturday. Oregon rushed the ball 261 yards, like I said, to Iowa's just over 100. Like, Oregon did what Iowa was supposed to do to Iowa, at Iowa, in the rain, in the cold, in the snow, in a crazy environment. I never thought that that's how this game was going to go down. Now, Iowa played how they want to play. They wanted to keep it low scoring. They wanted to keep it close, and that's why I picked Iowa. But to see how Oregon wins this game, man, I came, you know, out of it just so impressed with Dan Lanning and that Oregon Ducks team to battle through everything that they happened. That 2-minute drive, man. I don't know if Oregon wins that game with Bo Nix or Dylan Gabriel. Do those guys make that throw that Dante Moore makes down the field to Malik Benson? I don't know that they do, and I think that could be a difference going forward. But I do think these injuries are going to be a problem, Judah. Dante Moore didn't look healthy. He had that breakaway run in the third quarter where he just kind of pulled up, ran out of bounds. He was in the second half before that final drive. He was 8 of 15 passing for 65 yards. That's not going to do it for you. And I love Dante Moore.
A couple of drops in there, no?
Right, but still, okay, 10 completions for what?
They didn't throw it a lot. 80, they were busy running.
They weren't throwing
crap out of the ball.
But Dante Moore just didn't look healthy. He hasn't looked healthy the last couple of
games.
And
he didn't have, you know, DeCorian Moore and Sadiq.
And Gary Bryant Jr. goes Gary out Bryant. Early in the game. So, look, yeah. I think Dante Moore is going to have to be healthy if Oregon wants to make any type of noise in the college football playoff. This is definitely a CFP-worthy team, and I think that they do win out. I think they go 11-1, and they're in
you
the
do.
Playoff. Yeah, I do.
What do you think about that? Obviously, well, I wish I shouldn't say obvious. What is the toughest game for Oregon?
It's the USC game.
All right.
I don't trust, but... I don't trust Washington. Washington's looked bad in the two big-time games they played against Michigan and Ohio State. Now they go and lose to Wisconsin, like... whatever, but when they played a big time elite schools, they looked bad. So I don't trust them. USC should be able to score some points against Oregon. I don't know if they'll be able to stop them all. There could be one of those games where Oregon runs for 260 again on USC and pushes them around. So I think this is Lanning's most impressive win to me. I think Oregon's going to be a college football playoff team, but I still think there are questions of how elite are they? Like, I don't necessarily think they're a national title contender, but I do think that they're going to be in the CFP.
Well, you just hit on something really, you know, quality. Oregon is still in the national title conversation, but that team that you saw over the weekend with the injuries, that team's not winning the championship.
They have to get healthy. That's the thing.
Yeah, they have to get healthy and then
maybe
play their best.
Maybe they want the bye week this year.
And you know what?
Get healthy.
Yeah, right. It's funny that you mentioned that Oregon out Iowa'd Iowa. Because I would agree that they did. And Iowa was the team that made a few more mistakes than Oregon. You know, obviously the punt for the safety is one. They fumbled twice in the game, at least once. The game swung to me, Oregon leading 12-7 late third quarter. Iowa driving into plus territory. Brandon Finney Jr. makes a hell of a tackle. Forces a fumble. Somehow, the side judge comes in and says, no, I saw that he was down. And the dude didn't see anything because he's blocked from where the football is. He rules him down. I couldn't believe that review was taking painfully so long before they finally correctly gave it as a fumble and an Oregon Duck recovery. I would have lost it if they would have had that one of those Ohio State moments from the Autzen game where it was a clear fumble forced by Oregon, but they couldn't change it on review. That was painful. But then Oregon goes down. That's when you get the big run on the read keep by Dante Moore, but then Dante Moore trips on his, you know, right guard or his center's leg on a 3rd-and-2, forces Sappington to kick a field goal. He makes it to go up 15-7. Even in that moment, I would not have bet that Oregon would be the team having to make a final minute drive to win and not lose. I would have said 15-7, that's a good spot. Credit to Iowa for coming back with that offense.
Yeah, then Iowa kicks a 58-yard field goal in terrible conditions. Act like it's
banged
nothing.
It. Incredible from that kicker, and then getting the 3rd-and-5 deep ball from like inside their own 10-yard line out to midfield. You can't have that if you're the Duck defense either.
Didn't it seem like Iowa was going to win that game? When they completed that deep pass and they're going down the field, I'm like, man, this is an Iowa win.
Kind of, but there were still 7 minutes left in the game when they got to midfield.
But they wore it all the way down to the 2-minute.
Exactly. And this is where the clock management part comes into me. Now, I get you want to keep your timeouts. But then I would have used a couple. When Dante Moore makes the throw to Benson, there's 30 seconds left in the game with a running clock, and you're still shy of the 50. Like, that is not good clock management. And Dan Lanning is talking pretty animatedly to Will Stein about that and Dante Moore on the sideline. I didn't know. Clearly, they were not on the same page with how they wanted to manage the clock, but to their credit, Moore came up so big with that throw. What a catch by Benson, and what a great kick by Sappington. But I do not trust Oregon's coaching staff in late-game situations to handle the clock correctly. And, Stephen, that's not to mention Iowa's go-ahead touchdown. You know, they had to convert a couple fourth downs there late, but they have fourth and goal from, what, the 2.5 or so, and they go empty.
Yeah, who didn't know
that's kind of your antennas up that there's a draw.
And Kronowski has a running touchdown in every game of the season. He
Oregon counters with something that's like halfway sound, which is Tatum Tuiati as a spy at the linebacker spot, but you only have three down linemen. That's not enough bodies to allow Tuiati to stay free and account for the quarterback. It's not enough bodies. The three guys are blocked, and then Tuiati commits to a gap too early, runs into his own guy, and that's easy. It's like a half-baked scheme idea that almost looked good, but was not good enough and was executed so poorly. You can't be giving up walk-in touchdowns on fourth and goal to Iowa on the road. So they're, to me, incredibly tough, resilient, gritty win. I totally agree with you. I think you have a point with best win of the Dan Lanning era. I might quibble with that a little bit, but I think it's a worthy one to bring up. But at the same time, there's enough with this team, the injuries and the coaching strategy and down late. This is not a national. It's not a national championship team. That's for sure. It's a playoff team. It's not a national championship team.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. I think Lanning's always going to kind of be fighting these X's and O's in game situations because he's still such a young coach, and we do view him more as a recruiter than anything. Like that's how we view this guy. And Will Stein and Tosh LaPoy still young coordinators as well. Like this is still such a young coaching staff that there's going to be those type of questions. But I think all your valid, you know, all those points are valid that they didn't necessarily, you know, figure it out. But at the end of the day, they got the field goal unit on the field.
That throw and catch was pretty clutch.
You know, definitely a makeable field goal inside 40 yards. Like yeah. You can't ask for much more than that. And
right.
You know, I look at this, some of the stuff that they did throughout the game, you know, take away the last final drive from Iowa, you know, Kamari Moulton. He had a long of 16. So you take away that one run, 22 carries, 71 yards for him. Like they bottled him up. And I think you look at that game and like, I think that was just more, it was more of an identity for Oregon to kind of prove to, I think, more of the nation of like, look, this team isn't like this flashy Chip Kelly offense anymore. Like get with it. Like they haven't been that for years. And they are trying to build this Big Ten SEC type of style defense and physicality. And they proved it against Iowa. Now, can they do it against an Ohio State? Can they do it against an Alabama? I don't know. But they did it in a really tough environment, and I was very impressed.
Well, they proved it against Penn State. And then they had their physical card taken away from them against Indiana.
Ripped right away.
And then they proved it again against Iowa. So is it too harsh to rule out Oregon as a national championship winning program this season? That would be my question. They proved so much against Iowa, and they proved that they're certainly worthy of making the playoff. But have you seen enough, or are there enough data points at this point to say that they can't win the national championship? Right now, I would say they're not a national championship team, but I'm willing to be talked off that ledge. 503-417-7575. Coming up on the show, we'll talk some NFL. We'll talk some Beavs. That was a tough one for the Beavs. Tough one for the Beavs as three touchdown favorites losing on senior night. Ryan Harlan will join us. He covers the program. Plus Spencer McLaughlin at 4 o'clock. We'll talk some Ducks and college football as well. Judah Newby and Stephen Vaughn in for John Cazano. We'll take some of your reaction next at 503-417-7575 on the Bald-Faced Truth.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
In the last throw they made, throw and catch him, it's just, you talk about a matter of inches. It was a great throw. Guy did a good job bringing it in. TJ had great coverage, and he's been playing his ass off all year. So, you know, sometimes that's football when you play a team like Oregon. You know, you got to be right there.
That was Kirk Ferentz after the game. Oregon 18, Iowa 16. A great final score for a really great football game and a great win. Judah Newby, Stephen Vaughn in for John Cazano. Stephen says, this is Dan Lanning's best win of his Oregon Duck tenure.
Most impressive one for me. Obviously, the best one I think is Ohio State, just because you know they're the highest ranked team that they beat. But most impressive, I can't wait more impressive with this game than the Ohio State game.
I still think the win over Colorado. No, I'm just kidding.
That was a big win.
That was a great speech and a great win. I think the Penn State game is getting treated with a little too much. It's being dismissed a little too much in retrospect, even though we know Penn State isn't quite the team that we thought they were, but technically neither is Oregon, right? After the loss to Indiana, we didn't, no one I saw picked Indiana, and that is going to still stick with this Duck team throughout, but they shook off a lot of those demons, injured, banged up, down at the end in a hostile atmosphere, got the win. Huge for the Ducks. Some of your calls, 503-417-7575. We'll start with Cam in Eugene on the line. What's up, Cam?
Hey, you're right. Nobody picked Indiana to beat the Ducks, but a ton of bettors last week put their money down on Iowa to beat the Ducks. And I have a couple of just thoughts about the Oregon game, and then a big one at the end that I'd like to get both of your reaction on. Thank you for holding down the fort today, by the way. So I thought it was a great game. I usually don't get super excited when Oregon scores 18 points, even if they win, but quarterbacks are built like a brick wall, one brick at a time. And to give Dante Moore a successful rep, going back out there with limited time to set up the game-winning drive and get the win against a great defense in a hostile environment, that's just so important for his maturation. I'll trade that for any 40-point win we've ever had. And again, you know, running the ball was excellent for Oregon. I've never understood where the offensive line concerns have come from. We ran for over 5 yards to carry against Indiana. The only time the offensive line has looked bad is in passing situations, and in fairness, Dante Moore takes a little bit more time to get the ball out than either Bo Nix I'm losing the name right now, but the quarterback who went to the Browns last season.
Gabriel,
Gabriel, thank you, Dylan Gabriel. So that was really good, and there was a lot to take away and like about it. But Oregon a few years ago had to make a tough decision. They went to a conference that arguably really didn't want them. A conference where there is an open secret that certain teams are favored. And so we're seeing some wonky stuff. Oregon has to play 4 games this season against teams coming off of a bye week, to include Penn State, who had the unilateral bye week before Oregon's matchup with them. And they were the soft pick by the conference to, you know, be the class of the league this year. It obviously didn't work out, but they definitely set them up for success. And you mentioned in the last segment, the fumble call on Saturday. There was also the hands to the face call. There was also the offensive pass interference call. There was also the missed call for intentional grounding, which happened in Iowa's final drive. And I believe there was another missed one. If memory serves, they tried to give him the 2-point conversion, had to be overturned by the booth. It was clearly caught out of bounds. And again, this is a conference where they like their legacy teams. Michigan doesn't have to play on Friday. They're excused from that because they don't want to, and they're Michigan, so they don't have to. And kind of felt like the redheaded stepchild in the conference the last 2 years we've been there. And now seeing the result last weekend, I was reviewing the game yesterday. Once I got home, I had to listen to some of it on the radio when it was actually going on. And my mind actually went to Chauncey Billups, because there were arrests made in this sting operation on sports gambling yesterday. The scope of it widened. We've now got baseball players involved in it. And when you look at how Oregon has been treated by the Big Ten and how the Big Ten looks out for its legacy teams, and you look at what happened in that game, that's not an unlikely result. It's frankly suspicious. There's enough there, and this is the hot take I wanted the response on. Dan Lanning shouldn't be elevating this to the Big Ten. He shouldn't even be elevating it to the NCAA. He should be reporting it to the FBI. And we have reached the moment in college sports now where we can no longer sweep bad officiating under the rug. When you've got really, truly wonky calls that potentially have an effect, an outsized effect on the outcome of the game, there has to be some sort of quick turnaround protocol to make sure that those were bad calls and not truly corrupt things that are happening to try and swing the outcome of a game or a betting line one way or another. We're no longer in an age where we can give the benefit of the doubt. We have to assume that there may be something there. What say you?
All right. Thanks, Kim and Eugene. I mean, it's spicy. It is spicy.
Did the Ducks win? I forgot. I didn't know.
Yeah,
I mean, the caller is kind of, you know, like, look, I
get the FBI on the phone.
Yeah, the Ducks won the game. Like, how are we getting the call, you know, the FBI there?
Let's go. Rachel in Eugene has been holding. Hey, Rachel.
Yeah, let's do that, guys. As a Duck fan, I want you to know it does cause me physical pain to agree with you that we are a playoff team but not a win the natty team. But I want to talk a little bit to other Duck fans that are listening, especially about why that is and why the future is really bright for this team, okay? Because when we look at recruiting parity, the NIL stuff, the transfer portal, and the hiring of Lanning, who has, coming from Georgia and Alabama recruiting veins, right? For the first time ever, guys, I mean, we have the best team on roster paper that we've ever had in the history of the program, bar none. It is not even close, right? Yet these last two seasons, I've expected us to make the playoffs, but come up short if we made it into the Natty, like in 2010, like in 2015. And the reason is, it's the reason Washington lost. We went into that national championship game. I can't even remember who beat them, right? I'm not great with details like that. But they went in there, and I knew they were going to lose. And the reason I knew it, folks, is because they had one five-star player on the roster, and their opponent had 15. So, like, we are now building that five-star, the reputation that we're talking about. It's taken us 20 years of winning to move beyond flashy and fast, right? But we're building it now. And I think, like, this Natty, we're going to get this Natty under Dan Lanning.
Thank you for the call. I love that. Yeah, it seems more sustainable, especially, remember with Chip, when it got to its height of explosive, fast-paced offense, with every passing game and every passing season, it was like, can Chip take this to the NFL? Can Chip take this to the NFL? And your hope that was that once he took it to the NFL, like he did going to Philly in 2013, that you could just keep that going with the next hire in line. And that was Mark. Didn't work out after a few seasons, but you did go to another national championship game in 2014, losing to Ohio State. This feels more sustainable for a couple of reasons. One, stylistically. Two, recruiting depth. And three, seems like the guy really wants to stay for the long haul. So I do agree with that. This feels like it's got a better foundation of national relevance and success for the next 5 to 10 years than it even felt in the Chip days.
100%, yeah. And I remember before the year, we had Brett Cianci on, and he said, look, the 2026 national champions, 2026-27 national champions will be Oregon. Not this year, but next year. Like, that, to the caller's point, they are still building to... Not saying that they're not trying to win the national title this year, but they're still building to get that team. And, going back into the Chip Kelly days, it always was kind of a gimmick, right? Like, they were the flash team that was running something that other teams weren't doing, and everyone was trying to catch up. Well, they didn't win the national title. They were so close. Michael Dyer, all that kind of stuff. So close to winning the national title. Right? With the Chip Kelly stuff. But as you said, Judah, this is more sustainable. Like, they look like a Georgia. They look like an Alabama-type team. Maybe not to that level quite yet, but they are building Ohio State. They're building it the way those schools have built it to win national championships. They're doing it the right way. They have the right guy in Dan Lanning. It may just be another season or two of getting more and more five stars in there, and I think the portal's going to help them with all the money that they have. They can go out and they can fill in their roster and fill in that way, and I think Oregon's doing it the right way. I think they are maybe still a year away. Maybe 2 years away, but they're building it the right way.
Well, and I heard from a Duck fan over the weekend that Dante Moore might come back next year. Which
Todd McShay said it's lock it in. He's coming back next year.
Okay. All right.
So we'll see. He also is like one of the favorites to be the number one overall pick in the NFL draft next year.
The opinions change, it seems like, with every passing game.
With the NIL money, I mean, if he's going to be making $5, $6 million and he can still develop and he can still learn some things, as we've learned, like, when you leave early in college as a quarterback, sometimes you struggle in the NFL. And so maybe you do want to stay one more year. And we see how it happened for Bo Nix, how it raised his stock. Dylan Gabriel raised his stock. Maybe it'll raise Dante Moore even more to be a number one overall pick.
Could be. Also, if you keep Will Stein in the fold and all his name being tossed around some coaching search, that would be big as well. I don't want to discount. Everybody's talking about Oregon's physicality as if it's a new thing. It preceded even Dan Lanning. Like, Mario Cristobal is the one that really committed to the physicality in the trenches. I mean, do we not remember? Like, he would be out there both as an O-line coach under Taggart, but even as a head coach, blowing his whistle, getting the guys fired up. Like, this physicality identity of Oregon has been reinforced for 5 to 7 years, not just the last 2 years under Lanning. It's just gotten better, more heightened, and more effective, except for the Indiana game and the Ohio State game.
When we talk about Oregon, is all the national perspective, because people don't necessarily watch the teams on the West Coast still. Like, that's just not how it is in college football. And so some teams people are still just catching up that Oregon is not just...
And Oregon doesn't do themselves any favors when they beat Iowa by Idaho by 3 points.
Right.
People like, hey, that's just one game. Yeah, but from a national perspective, that still lingers in the backs of people's minds. Roy is in Portland. Roy has called in. We might see a Georgia-Oregon playoff game this year, Roy. That would be a lot of fun.
Nah, you guys not going to make it that far to see us in the playoffs. So I'm just going to say that right now, man. I like Oregon, but y'all not on the level of us this year. I mean, I thought at first that Georgia wasn't good, but, man, they have surprised me. I mean, they've gotten better and better each week, and I think they are possibly a national championship team. You know, but I just, to that last caller, to the caller talking about the FBI and all that stuff, man, listen, I've been a Georgia fan for years, and I've seen Alabama teams that would just beat us all the time. And you had Georgia fans just swearing, oh, the refs are in it for Georgia, and it's some type of conspiracy theory that, you know, they're in it for the Nick Saban, they want to win a national championship. No, refs make bad calls, man. You know, that's just part of the game. You know what I mean? There's not no big conspiracy theory about it, or the FBI got to get involved in it. You know, I just don't – the Big Ten is so bad, man. It's just so – I'm not trying to take nothing away from Oregon, but, man.
How many teams from the Big Ten make –
the Big Ten is terrible.
How many teams from the Big Ten make the playoff, Roy?
In the Big Ten?
Yeah.
I think two. That's Indiana and Ohio State. Because I think – if Oregon could make it, yes, they could make it. If they sweep, they can make it. But if they do anything, if they lose this game, or if it even looks close, I think, in like if, say, you win a Washington game by like a field goal or something, you got too many one-loss SEC teams. You got Ole Miss. You got Georgia. You got Alabama. You got an undefeated Texas A&M. I just don't – you got what? You got to get
So if you had to pick, Oregon has Minnesota, USC, both those are at home, and then they're at Washington. Are they running the table the rest of the year?
I'm saying USC is the first toughest game. Then Washington at Washington is always going to be tough. Mm-hmm. And then don't take Minnesota lightly either. I'll put that on the third, you know, at the bottom. But they got to run the table, man. I mean, don't overlook USC. Don't overlook Washington at Washington. But if they run the table, they should be able to get in. But last week with the committee saying they looked like a good team and we don't know, you know, I think they looking for anything not to get Oregon in there. And you know there's going to be SEC teams lobbying for like, oh, how could you put the – who have they played? That's the first thing they're going to say. Look at what Texas did, or look at what this, you know. So, I mean, that Penn State game, it was okay, but – I think Oregon is just a victim of the bad Big Ten, man. It's just a bad league. Michigan is bad. You know, you got Indiana, which is – I don't believe in Indiana either. So, I mean, but it's basically Ohio State. You got three teams, Ohio State, Indiana, and Oregon. So, Oregon doesn't play Ohio State. They got beat by Indiana. So, that's the tough part about this. If the Big Ten was better, I'd say, yeah. You know, Oregon is definitely in, but they definitely got a sweep. It would be not a two-loss Oregon team does not get in. I'm just saying, you cannot lose to any of these teams and get into the playoffs. So,
I think that. Thanks for the call, Roy. Yeah,
Point, though, Judah, because if it's going to be interesting to see, is Iowa ranked in the top 25 after this loss? Or, I mean, after this win over by Oregon over Iowa? If they're not ranked, Oregon doesn't have that top 25 win. If they beat USC, does USC drop out of the top 25? Washington's going to drop out of the top 25. So Oregon has a chance to have no top 25 wins on this season. Like, to Roy's point, they may have to go 11-1 because they have no top wins on this
season. That'd be unfortunate if USC falls out of the top 25 because Oregon beats them, right? That's my problem with not having any top 25 wins on a team's final ranking. They dropped out of the top 25 because we won the game. Like, you shouldn't penalize a team for winning. The whole process is really, really
the whole process is stupid. I agree. Bizarre. But that's how it works, right? Yeah. Like, in the AP poll this week, Oregon in numerous polls dropped. Ole Miss moved up. Ole Miss beat the Citadel. Oregon beat a team on the in the top 20 the road and dropped. So, like, it is a lot of just perception.
You're assuming the AP voters watched the game.
They don't. We all know this. But that's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying. If Oregon keeps winning,
if we need the FBI on anything, it's the AP.
Yeah. Unfortunately, with their wins might knock teams out of the top 25.
All right. We'll hit a break and come back. More your reaction. 503-417-7575. Do we need to call the FBI about college football officiating? Is Oregon a good team? Yes. We all agree Oregon's a good team. We all agree they are playoff caliber team, whether or not they make it. Are they national championship caliber?
Does Dan Lanning need to start selling this team as a college football playoff team, as Roy said? Because he's at the SEC, he's going to start marketing themselves. Hey, we deserve to be in. Does Lanning need to start a campaign as well?
Do we need to get this private equity firm that's buying the Big Ten? We need their marketing dollars.
We need a campaign.
We need them
to
use AI to convince the playoff committee and Mike Riley that Oregon is the best team in the country. This is where we are. College Football Discourse 2025. We'll bounce a break and come back. Judah Newby, Stephen Vaughn in for John Canzano on the Boldfaced Truth.
You've got the home of the truth. Back to the Boldfaced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
You know, to get the ball back with a little bit of time and our guys go execute a two-minute drive, I think just tells you the heart and resiliency of our group. We talk about strength in numbers. We had some guys that had to step up their opportunities, and they were ready for their opportunities this week, which is unbelievable.
Judah Newby, Stephen Vaughn in for John Canzano, Boldface Truth. Take a couple of your calls along the way. I think Oregon is about 75% of what a national championship team looks like. And so my question for them is, do they find that extra 25% in these last three games of the regular season, both in terms of performance and health? Like, do they get the key guys back, DeCorian Moore, Harkey, and obviously Sadiq, Gary Bryant, what's his thing, and does Evan Stewart come back? So if not, and look, I think they're a playoff team. I just don't think they're a national championship team, and yet what a gritty, gutsy, tough, trench-filled victory that was in bad conditions in Iowa. All the respect in the world for that. Still got big questions, though, as it regards to the biggest of stakes. Curious where you sit on that at 503-417-7575. Charlie is in Vancouver. What's up, Charlie?
Hey, guys. First of all, I think this is the year where a team doesn't have to be a 100% national championship team to win it. I think there's a lot of really good teams. Not sure there's a great team. Second, as far as the FBI gambling, I think there are more home favored calls in college football and college basketball than any other sport. And it's just brutal. It's because it's not like the NBA where, you know, guys maybe from one part of the country and they're reffing another part of the country. You got local boys doing those games, and they're going to see those people 364 days a year after that. And there's a lot of inborn pressure. I mean, holding calls especially, pass interference calls. I think those calls can be manipulated tremendously. I mean, I heard the guys on the radio complaining that, oh, the Ducks are being held every single play. They should be making these calls. Well, go watch an Oregon home game and tell me the same thing. The other team probably isn't saying the same thing. I think it's brutal, but I think it's the way it is. I do think we're at the tip of the iceberg with the gambling thing, though. When you get guys, and I think prop betting has to end right now, because these guys apparently were making $40,000 or something like that for throwing a ball in a certain inning, a ball in a baseball game. And, you know, in their minds, they're going, who cares? Ain't going to affect the game. Sure, I'll take my $40,000, you know, whatever amount it is. Prop betting has to end because of that. Otherwise, sports are kind of just entertainment. The one question I'll leave you guys with is, yes, Oregon is really building themselves a national reputation and should be fine for the future. And I hate to be morbid, but what happens when Uncle Phil's gone and that pipeline of money is gone? Because to me, money is the most important thing in the near future. It's NIL money. Who cares whether you have new uniforms, green and gold, anything like that? How much can you pay me? And when Uncle Phil's not writing those checks behind the scenes, I think it's going to level out pretty quick.
It's an interesting call. To that point, I don't think it's a coincidence that Oregon's in favor of this, you know, $1 billion of private equity coming into the Big Ten as Phil Knight keeps getting older and getting that assured money revenue streams coming. I don't think that's a coincidence.
To the ref thing, just know, every fan in every sport, the refs suck. Just know that going into the game. Like, don't expect you to get calls. And this is coming from a guy who, I worked with the Blazers, I worked in the NBA. I know the refs are going to suck in every single game. Just know they're going to make bad calls. Like, I don't, it's going to be very few and far between that the games are found out to be rigged and the refs are a part of it. That's happened, like, what, once with Tim Donaghy? It's never been proven by anybody else. Like, just know the refs are going to suck. You're probably not going to get calls if you're the road team. And you're going to have to beat the other team on the field and the refs. That's what's going to happen. And Oregon did that.
Mark is in Portland. Hey, Mark.
Steven, it's we as fans, we tend to look for excuses why our team lost. And it's always the quarterback, the coach, the refs. And, you know, I mean, that FBI call, I don't know where he was going with that. I mean, it's, you know, you got to deal with what's on the field. And when you're playing at Iowa or at Penn State, it's going to be, you know, it's going to be home cooking more than likely. The refs just psychologically, because the fans are going to all cheer. They make, you know what I mean? But I wanted to address Roy's call. He's been calling here your radio station the last few years, telling us how weak the Big Ten is, how weak Ohio State is. And correct me if I'm wrong, haven't they won the last two national titles? And really, Washington and Michigan was an all Big Ten title. So the tide has changed. We don't really know how good the SEC is. We don't. Didn't Ole Miss, who's one of their top contenders, didn't they struggle to beat Washington State? Was that?
Yeah, they had to pull away late to beat Wazoo.
Right, 24-21. And, yeah. And Alabama, who's undefeated and looks like the favorite to win the SEC, lost to Florida State, who sucks. So the polls mean nothing to me, and I live for the day that the playoff goes to like 16 teams.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. We're up against it. Sorry to cut you off, but a point well taken. We'll continue the conversation in an hour or two here on the Bald-Faced Truth.
BFFT. Now, built by High Caliber Millwrights. In for John Canzano, here's Jude and Newby and Stephen Vaughn with the Bald-Faced Truth.
Spencer McLaughlin talks all things college football and Oregon Ducks on the Locked On Podcast Network, Locked On Ducks, Locked On College Football, among other things. And he joins us coming up. He also is a contributor at 750thegame.com. Got some posted stuff there a couple of times a week talking Oregon football. Later this hour, Ryan Harlan, Beaver's Edge, will stop by the program as well. Oregon State, not a great weekend for them, not a great Saturday night, and now all of a sudden TJ Houshmandzadeh feels like he's getting the Heisman from the program while he's trying to help the boys out. Took a lot of your calls in hour one reacting to Oregon's win at Iowa. Oregon 18, Iowa 16. Just a beautiful final score for some good old school Big Ten football and a big road win for the Ducks, but it came at a cost, both in terms of injuries leading up to the game. Hopefully the quarterback is doing okay as well, but we'll see where the playoff committee ranks them Tuesday when the latest rankings come out. Spencer McLaughlin joining us on the guest hotline right now. Jude Anubi, Stephen Vaughn in for John Canzano. Spencer, wow, what a game. Stephen, my co-host here, he says this is Dan Lanning's most impressive win of his tenure, this win over Iowa. Do you agree with that?
No, I think you still have to go with Ohio State a season ago. I mean, certainly it's one of the best pure coaching jobs that Lanning has done, and I in no way want to downplay it or anything of that nature. I think that it was a really difficult game to win. Iowa is a good, solid team. The conditions were really difficult. You're missing three offensive starters and one on defense. Devin Jackson didn't play in that game either, and you find a way to win, and the execution was just so good down the stretch. Special teams has a great day on a weather day that can make it really hard to kick or snap the ball. There were no issues there. I think this was an outstanding win and one of the best coaching jobs Lanning has done, and a marker for the amount he's grown as a head coach over the last couple of years. I wouldn't say it's the best. I think you still have to go with Ohio State last year, even though that game was at home. You know, you look at what that team went on to accomplish and what they had accomplished leading up to that game and all the hype and expectation. And that was a big breakthrough moment. Certainly this was another one, but
I think that game on Saturday was just a heck of an effort and a true team effort as well.
Well, and Steven, to your point, you're saying most impressive, like best would still be the Ohio State game, but most impressive considering the circumstances.
Yeah, I just think, you know, the Ohio State game, obviously that was the best team that they played, that Lanning's beaten, but just the circumstances, the weather, the injuries, just going into that Iowa game, it just seemed like that was the most impressive game. I do want to ask you, what was the most impressive part of this win by the Oregon Ducks, Spencer? Because, look, I mean, you follow the Ducks, we follow the Ducks. We know they're not just this flash team. We're not one of the national media guys. We know this is a tough team, but what was the most impressive part of this victory coming away for Oregon out of Iowa City?
The way that they were able to execute in all three phases, I think, was just so impressive to watch, because there are so many ways that things can go wrong. And when you have that, it just underscores how great of a job the staff did having their guys prepared, how well they executed the play calling on both sides of the ball for the most part, I thought was really, really good. And I think that, you know, being shorthanded in a game like that makes it even tougher. And then when you look at what they were going against on that final offensive drive, the execution, that's kind of the word that keeps popping into my head for this Oregon team and what was so impressive about it, that, you know, the defense played just about how I expected. I thought Iowa would score 13 points. They wind up with 16 and got some help from the officiating crew in order to get there. But that was, you know, about what I expected. Obviously, the 93-yard touchdown drive is disappointing to give up in that spot. But to then be able to come back and dig deep and have the intestinal fortitude to go down the field in the rain on the road with your playoff hopes maybe on the line, I think that was just a remarkable stretch of football there for Oregon to play in that situation.
It was incredible resilience and resolve. I will grant that. There's a couple of things that still bother me about the Ducks and maybe their potential and their ceiling. And this is not me necessarily trying to nitpick, because I think this was incredibly gritty, tough win, and not every team wins that game. But, you know, there are a couple of things. One, you're up 15-7. I wouldn't have put Iowa in the category of offenses to be able to come back and take a 16-15 lead in the fourth quarter. Number one, like deep balls over the top on third and five, you know, that, you know, putting Tatum Tuiati as that kind of a spy / solo linebacker there on the quarterback keeper on the fourth and goal. Like, in theory, that's a good idea, but you don't have enough down linemen to occupy the offensive line to keep him free. He ends up shooting a gap too early. Like, you can't have that execution and that scheme and that leverage of a moment when the play call to me is kind of that predictable. Like, so there's something there. And I didn't like the clock management on the final drive completely. Like, yes, it's an incredibly clutch play from Moore to Benson, but they're shy of midfield with less than 30 seconds and still all their timeouts at their disposal. I was getting uncomfortable with their clock management down the stretch, and it probably shouldn't have come down to that kind of a clutch moment, even though certainly, you know, incredible play by Moore to Benson. Am I nitpicking there, or do you still have a couple of those flaws that you've got your eye on that considers Oregon a bit fortunate in addition to their toughness to win this game?
I don't think the level of detailed criticism is unwarranted. When you want to go win a national championship, those are sometimes the things that it comes down to. You know, last year, I think you could have very easily seen it as nitpicking to point out that Oregon safeties were exploitable and the rest of the team was just so good that, you know, they overcame that at times. And then the Rose Bowl happened, and what did Chip Kelly and Ryan Day do? They went right at Oregon safeties the entire game, any opportunity that they could, and exploited Oregon, and we all know how that went. I did not have as big of a problem with the clock management there at the end, because when you've got three timeouts and you're just on your own side of midfield in 30 seconds, you're giving yourself the maximum number of opportunities to continue to move the ball forward, which you need to do because you don't want to try and kick a 50 plus yard field goal. You know, everybody can do that against Oregon, but Oregon doing it, goodness gracious, we'd be asking too much. But I think that in that spot, you don't want to condense your playbook and have them thinking, well, they have to go to the sideline now, because now you're putting yourself in a spot where it's even tougher to get closer, and you have to, because you don't want the elements to come into play. and Oregon got themselves down inside, you know, it wound up being a 39-yard field goal. So they got inside the 30-yard line, and they still had a timeout if, you know, that sideline shot to Benson to the end zone had been completed short of the goal line. Oregon wouldn't have had to run up to spike. And if that had been second down instead of third down, they could have run one more play to either center the ball or get a couple of yards closer. So, no, I didn't have a problem. And in real time, I didn't have a reaction at all to that. I felt good about where they were at. And then, obviously, it worked out because they won the game.
Spencer, what did you make of the officiating in the game? We've had numerous callers callers calling for the FBI to be involved. Are you at that level, or is it just bad?
No, I'm not calling for the FBI to get involved.
People, the FBI.
Is it a Big Ten thing?
Is it a Big Ten trying to boost
schools? No, it's not contained to the Big Ten. Every conference, you hear this in the Pac-12 a lot, because the Pac-12 officials had some colossal screw-ups from time to time. But every conference thinks they have the worst officiating in the country. SEC fans will tell you that. I'm sure every other league's fans will tell you that. And it was just the fact of the matter is, what's unfortunate is this job of officiating, this applies to Major League umpiring as well, it's clearly too difficult of a job for these guys. It's clearly too hard. I don't doubt that they're trying. I think they want to get it right. I've met these guys before and talked to them. I know that they take it seriously, that they want to get it right. And I just watch over and over and over again. It's clearly too difficult for them. And it's unfortunate in football because you can't have robotic assistance in a number of areas. In baseball, the solution is easy. Stop letting these guys be behind the plate and call balls and strikes. They're clearly not able to do it at a high level. I'm sorry. That's just the way that it is. I've got enough evidence to know that that's the case. But in football, I guess we just have to live with it. But the lack of public accountability for years is infuriating. Iowa was flagged for one penalty for 1 yard in this game. And Kirk Ferentz is a heck of a football coach, and I did not expect, nor would I ever expect, watch an Iowa game, because it's not how they play, where they have 9 penalties for 110 yards. But I can go back, and I have watched the entire game, and I saw so many blatant missed calls that helped Iowa in a number of ways. And there were missed calls against Oregon, to be sure. But Oregon is also flagged, I think it was, what, 5 times for 57 yards? 57 yards, half the field in a game that was decided by 2 points, went in favor of the Hawkeyes. And I'm not going to attribute malice unless I have an actual reason. So I'll attribute incompetence. The crew was unacceptably bad, and the Big Ten should be ashamed of it.
If they would have ruled that 2-point conversion as a catch, I think that would have been your FBI moment.
I think that would have been a moment. But it's good to know the replay officials are still on top of it and getting stuff right. That whole sequence wasn't what I, you know, objected to, because in real time I thought it was a catch, and then I saw the replay and went, wait, it's not. Yeah. Then they look at the replay and then, it's not. The lack of holding penalties is the biggest grievance that Duck fans should have against the officiating in that game. But the other angle that I think has to be talked about with that is that should make Duck fans feel even better about winning that game. Because you went into it with enough obstacles already. You are on the road. It is an awesome crowd. The weather is brutally tough. You're facing a good team, and you're missing 3 offensive starters. And then your defense was held the entire game, and it wasn't called a single solitary time, and you still found a way to win. Because unfortunately, officiating is bad across college sports at a number of levels. And that's just the way that it can be sometimes, and it sucks, and it's frustrating, and I wish there was more public accountability. But in the meantime, when you're a good team, you figure out a way to overcome that, and Oregon did.
Spencer McLaughlin, Locked On Ducks, Locked On College Football. Spencer, how concerning are these Oregon injuries if they continue to linger into November?
Well, if you can run for 260 yards a game at Iowa, in a game where throwing is hard, who can't you run for 250 yards on? I'm not really, I'm not really sure. So I think that's at least an encouraging thing. I'm kind of going back and forth in my head on whether Sadiq or DeCorian Moore is the guy you would want back. But Oregon's going to have another rain game this week. So frankly, I think you'd make the case that Kenyon Sadiq is the guy that you'd want to have back, because the run blocking for the offensive line was sensational. And obviously you want to get Alex Harkey back into the fold because he's been a good player this year. But I think those injuries obviously matter. You want to bring him back. I'm not cratering Oregon's chances after watching that Iowa game with how they played without those guys on the floor, which, again, got to credit the coaching staff for the recruiting and talent development and retention of all those players, to where you could survive missing your two leading receivers and your starting right tackle, and you go to Iowa and amidst all those hurdles win that game. That's pretty awesome stuff from Dan Lanning and the staff.
Well, you talk about their chances if they aren't healthy. Just talk about their chances going forward. I mean, you got Minnesota and USC at home, Washington on the road. It's kind of a two-parter here. How would you rank that schedule, like in difficulty? And two, does Oregon have to win all those games to get in? Because I made the argument of, if Oregon does continue winning, they're going to knock all their wins and all those teams out of the top 25. They may not end up with the top 25 wins. Does Oregon need to go 11-1 to make the playoff, or can they afford a loss? And what's the difficulty of these three matchups?
Well, I'm going to be really interested to see what the committee does with Iowa after the loss. In my top 25 of Locked On College Football, I didn't drop them out, because if you lose a game that you were one play from winning, why am I supposed to see you radically different than if that kick hadn't gone through for Atticus Sappington? Results should matter, to be sure, but overall, I still think Iowa is a good team. I will be okay with Iowa falling out of the top 25 if they lose again to USC next week, which they probably will. But I think for the Ducks, 11-1 obviously gets you in. That's not even a question. 10-2 should get them in. I don't think it's a 100%. I think there's a 7 out of 10 confidence interval for me that 10-2 gets them in. But I do think they could run into the issue. You know, it's a different situation than Penn State. But that same fundamental problem of, well, that team's not ranked anymore, so, you know, who have you really beat? And lost to Indiana at home. Like, okay, that's fair to knock them for losing to Indiana at home compared to losing on the road. But I think 10-2 should get them in, but I can't say that with 100% with 100% certainty. So watch and see if Iowa stays in the top 25 this week. That'll matter a whole heck of a lot. I think regardless, Duck fans, as much as most wouldn't ever want to hear me say this, you have to root for USC next week to beat Iowa so that they are inside the top 20 by the time they play you, and then at the end of the year, 9-3 USC will be in the top 25, I believe. So that's the outlook for those games. Sorry, what was the second part of your question?
I just said rank the difficulty of the matchups between those three.
Yeah, I'm still putting Washington as the toughest remaining game. You know, weather dependent, like we saw last weekend, Washington is not built to play a low-scoring slugfest, and they failed to beat Wisconsin and lost their playoff hopes. But that game is still dangerous because you're on the road in a rivalry game, and now you're playing a Washington team who the best thing that team can do this year is beat Oregon. That is the most exciting thing Jed Fish could possibly deliver for Husky fans, is beating Oregon and either knocking them out of the playoff or at least having the victory and putting doubt in the Duck fans' minds that they will make the college football playoffs. So I think that Washington's still the toughest game, followed by USC. And then I think there's a gap between them and Minnesota, who's a solid team. And you might have another rain game this week that can condense stuff down and stop you from being able to go crazy. You know, Minnesota went on the road, lost to Iowa 41-3. Does Oregon have that in the rain this week? I think that'll come down to the Golden Gophers' ability to stop Oregon's rushing attack. In the last three games for Oregon, not weeks because there was a bye, has run for over 200 yards in every matchup, and that's a pretty good place to be if you're Will Stein calling plays.
Last thing for you, Spencer. Would you pick Ohio State today to be your national champion? And
yes.
If not, all right. Well, then number two, who is their biggest challenger of the teams, you know, ranked toward the top? The Indiana's, A&M's, Alabama's, Ole Miss, Texas Tech? Anybody that you think could give them the biggest scare?
Yeah, Indiana is the answer to the question when they play at their best. I think the Hoosiers are just a legitimately great team and have played that way this season. And yeah, they struggled with Penn State. Turns out it's hard to win in Happy Valley. Who could have foreseen? But I think that Ohio State has started to find their offensive rhythm. And because they haven't played a big game in a while, Julian Sain isn't getting the buzz that he deserves. But go look at his numbers. I'm pretty sure his completion percentage is at 81%. Not for the last month, for the season. He is completing around 80% of his passes. One of you can double check me in real time on that. But I think that for Ohio State, with their weapons, what they were missing early in the season was consistent quarterback play to get the ball to their wideouts. And now they have that, and there's nothing else they're missing. We know what Ryan Day is capable of as a head coach. He replaced both coordinators seamlessly. Their defensive talent has just been fantastic this year with all the guys they lost. And I just think that is the best team in college football. And until someone proves otherwise, I don't know who I would take over. I think Indiana is the biggest threat. I think Texas A&M is interesting. I don't know that I trust A&M physically to match up with Ohio State. I think the Buckeyes would push them around a little bit. Just my impression of the Aggies, who are good. I have them number three in my top 25, but I think if Ohio State played Texas A&M, I'm taking the Buckeyes by 8 to 10 points.
That's why you're bringing Spencer on, Judah. Expert, 80.9% completion percentage.
There it is, 80.9. It's just called having too much free time to look this stuff up, guys.
And 9.9 yards an attempt on top of that. It's not just short stuff. That's third in the country, really second in the country next to CJ Carr for yards per attempt. So impressive stuff from Julian Sain. Spencer, go Blazers. You know, we'll catch up with you soon down the road. Thanks for making time and talking a little Ducks and college football with us.
Yeah, anytime, guys. 10-4 Blazers, 8:56 to go, first quarter. Love to see it.
I'm now. There he is, and he'll be watching Jeopardy later tonight as well. The old soul in the young man's body. That is Spencer McLaughlin talking a little ball with us here on the show. Play Punch and Audio, and then we'll talk to Ryan Harlan. What was that Saturday night for the Beavers? Ryan with On3 Sports, plus the 5 and 5 leading you into Monday Night Football. Judah Newby, Stephen Vaughn in for Canzano on the Bald-Faced Truth.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
News-filled weekend in sports. Judah Newby and Stephen Vaughn in for John Canzano. Bald-Faced Truth taking you up to Monday Night Football. 5:15, Packers-Eagles. Stephen, who do you got tonight? I think the Pack are a short home favorite against Philly tonight.
Yeah, I'll take the Pack. You know, Monday night, home team. I always like to take the home team on Monday nights. And I think the Pack, you know, coming off the loss to the Panthers, you know, you want to get them in the bounce back spot there. So I'll take the Pack there. I think the Pack are the best. I don't think they're the best team in the NFC. I think that goes to the Eagles, but the Packers are in the discussion for the second best team, along with your old Seattle Seahawks as the second best team.
Talk to me. Well, let's do some punch and audio. We'll do it without the benchmark. And let's start with the Seahawks. Boy, incredible game that they had yesterday. I am a Seahawks fan, so I enjoyed every single moment of that. And
that game was over quickly, too. Oof,
it really was. Here's partly how it sounded.
Third down, 11. Here comes Knight, knocked away again. Loose. Here comes Lawrence. Holy smokes. Another touchdown by the same guy.
How about Tyrese Knight forcing two fumbles? DeMarcus Lawrence returning both of them for touchdowns. It was one of those games for the Seahawks to get out to a big lead. They win it 44-22. Chris Long loves this team.
Mike McDonald might end up being one of the dudes. I mean, he's already well on his way to being one of the dudes. And for Seattle, let them get home field advantage and you will be sorry. Let them get home field advantage, you will be sorry. Because that place is hell to play in. In the start of McDonald's tenure, they were not great at home. And now all of a sudden, they're starting to jump people at home in the first half and then put it in cruise control. And they were able to run the ball a little bit better today. I'll be interested to look at the All-22 to see how much the Shahid presence changes the way, you know, defenses play this group. Well, at least John Gannon, how he played this group. Because, yeah, one more weapon makes them scary.
Yeah, pretty great. Pretty great stuff. I like this coach. I'm a Mac McDonald guy. I have been for a while, even to last season. You win 10 games, you don't make the playoffs. But you could see the bones of it were pretty sound. He's in the locker room after the win.
When you score 44 points, okay, and you win game by 21 points, okay, and you close the game out on offense at the end, that's big time stuff in the NFL. Okay, at our place, okay, in the division, leaving no doubt, is some high-powered stuff. All right, you got to be proud of that, man. All right, so we're going to enjoy the heck out of this win. That's a great job. That's a great team win. We had guys go down this week. Okay, guys stepping up, making plays. That's freaking 70 guys on the roster. That's 12-1 stuff. That's awesome. Okay, that's great, great job. That is how we win. Okay, that is Seahawk football. How you prepare the whole week. Nobody flinches. All you do is you just nail every day. Okay, and then it's decisive, shocking. And then in the second half, get a little funky, and then it was relentless, okay? And then we finished the thing off.
Great job, man!
Yes, sir. Hey, Mob on three! One, two, three! Mob!
The guy is very smart. He connects with players. He's authentically himself. He is incredibly forward with his scheme. Not only are they starting to build Lumen into a home fortress, but these guys dominate on the road as well. Just one road loss in Mike McDonald's coaching tenure since he took over the Seahawks. And guess what's coming up for them this week? A road game at the LA Rams. Seahawks 7-2, Rams 7-2. Surely this will get the primetime spotlight. Surely this will end up on Sunday Night Football. No, it's just tucked away to a 1:05 p.m. regional start time on Fox. So the nation won't get to see it, but this is a sick, sick football game coming up Sunday.
What are you more impressed with the Seahawks? Because I think going into the season, you were probably more excited about the defense, like building off from last season with Mike McDonald year two, but the offense has been shockingly really good with Sam Darnold. Like, what
are you
more impressed with the offense now because of just how little expectations you had?
In Darnold in particular, only because we knew that he was a good regular season quarterback, but the way that he faltered at the end of last year, was so pronounced, it was hard to shake that.
Well, does that translate to the playoffs then? This offense?
This offense does, because up front they're more sound than Minnesota was, and their run game is more effective. Even though it's not a great run game, it's a good enough run game that's more effective than Minnesota. And Jaxon Smith-Njigba is the equal of Justin Jefferson.
He's incredible.
Who's just insane. And then Rashid Shaheed is going to be a different part of this. I think Clint Kubiak is incredible at how he's dialing this up. The Seahawks almost forgot that the Washington game was over and that they just kept going from the Washington dominant performance. And to me, Darnold has one incompletion in the first half the last two games combined. His accuracy is insane. It's like he went to the Josh Allen school of accuracy. Josh Allen was one of the most erratic quarterbacks in his rookie year. He only had his legs, and that was it. Then he goes to, you know, the Jordan Rodgers camp or whatever quarterback coach that he saw in the offseason, Jordan Palmer, I think, and now dominates and is incredibly accurate. Darnold looks very much the same thing. He is pinpoint. He is decisive. He is putting it in a bucket, like, every time. Tight coverage, open coverage, deep ball, middle, screen game. He's got such an athletic base about him, too, and he's so confident. I love where this team is going. Just a couple of hangups for me would be the amount of national love they're getting right now makes me uncomfortable. This is not the spot we are normally in. That's number one. Number two, hey, man, they got tough schedule down the stretch. At the Rams, that's tough. Versus the Rams, Thursday night, December 18th. Really tough game. You still have a home game with the Colts before you play the Rams that Thursday night, December 14th. Tough game. Colts are a damn good team. At Atlanta, it's not a gimme. Atlanta's feisty. You know, they're not winning these games, but defensively they can get after you. And versus the Vikings, tough team. You know, beat the Lions on the road. Didn't really, you know, Baltimore controlled the game yesterday, but I'm not riding off the Vikings yet. The only games that you think that are easy wins would be at Tennessee, November 23rd. But even the last two games to end the year, at Carolina, at San Francisco, those are going to be teams fighting for their playoff lives in all likelihood in one aspect or the other, and you can't write it off. I think the Seahawks are going to the playoffs, but it's a matter of, do you win the division and get your home field? How high in the NFC table do you finish? 13 wins might not be good enough, depending on the tie breaks with the Rams here. So 13-4, that looks like a great record, but I'm not sure if it'll be good enough. But even then, if they have to go on the road in the playoffs, it's still a team that you're pretty confident in going on the road and getting the job done.
You heard it here first. Gita Newby says, Seahawks, get your Super Bowl tickets now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I love this team. And,
offensively, they are deep everywhere, right? Like, they have numerous running backs, numerous receivers, numerous tight ends that they can throw out there. So they can
Outside of the offensive line, yeah. One thing would be right guard, Anthony Bradford is he's holding them back, but he's playing his butt off. He's just not that good of a player.
But when healthy, they can kind of match up against any defense, right? Like, if you want to run the ball, they can do that. You want to throw the ball deep, you can do that. You want to throw it a little short, you can kind of do that.
So the run game is the one thing. They haven't been good at running the ball this year. They've been fine. They've been fine, but they haven't been good. And that was the thing I would expect them to have been good at coming into the year, is running the ball. And they've been fine, but they're starting to piece it together. We'll see how far they can go. Indiana, Penn State, what a finish.
Mendoza in trouble. It's out. Touchdown. Wow. Omar Cooper. Unbelievable. Give him the Heisman Trophy now.
A lot of debate on if that was a good call or not. Gita Newby, as the head of the announcers critique club, was that a good call by Gus Johnson? A lot of people love it. A lot of people are like, man, that is classic Gus. Like, we need it. Others are like, that was absolutely horrible. You couldn't understand a word he said. Where do you fall in this Gus Johnson debate?
You know, normally I'm like, as long as you're authentically yourself, like, that's what you should go with. But unfortunately for the Gus bus on this one, I think that's a terrible call. And kind of distracted from the moment. But look, it's college football. It's not the NFL. Those two things are different for me. Giving him the Heisman now, he's talking about Mendoza, but it's the catch that's sick. Like, obviously the throw is good, but the catch is sick. Like, give him the Heisman now is a little much for me. And it sounded like he was losing his voice the entire final drive. Dial it back a little bit, Gus, and you would have hit the moment wonderfully. But as it is, he became the talking point, and what should have been the talking point should have been the win in the final game. What about you?
As I've gotten older, I don't like Gus Johnson as much. I love him in college basketball in the NCAA tournament. That's when he fit perfectly because it was just the chaos of that. I feel like when he does football stuff, like, it's a little over the top. Like, he's trying to make it one of these big time moments. Now, that catch was a big time moment and one of the most impressive catches I've ever seen. I didn't necessarily love it.
No.
I thought it was a little fabricated, but and then to add, you know, give him the Heisman already, I just thought that was like try to justify why he couldn't talk. I don't know. I thought it was a little over the top.
Yeah, I agree with that one as well. Rob Akey, Beavs lose to Sam Houston. I don't have a lot of hair left, but this left me pulling my hair out watching this one late Saturday night on the CW. Rob Akey, disappointed.
Well, I'm disappointed. I feel sick to my stomach for our seniors, obviously. Their last opportunity, none of us obviously had the intention of it ending like this one. And certainly, and not just the seniors, I feel for this whole team. And it was not the outcome we had, that we had looked for. The team needed to take care of the team. That's what worked for us a week ago. And we had some things that we didn't give ourselves the opportunity to be able to overcome tonight. And that's basically what it gets down to. And while there were some improvements in some areas, like we talked about last week, we talked about yards or whatever, you don't get yards, you can get points for those things. We got to win on the scoreboard, the way the scoreboard reads at the end of the game. So there's a lot of disappointment, and we have two more opportunities, and we're going to pick our boots up, and we're going to have these guys rolling, and we're going to go get after two new opponents.
I mean, this is such a bad loss, even though they outplayed him in so many other categories. But
474 to 157 in total yards. The Beavers outgained them by over 300 yards and lose the game.
The fourth down drop by Hankerson.
It would have been a walk-in touchdown.
Would have been a walk-in.
The block punts. More special teams disasters.
Turns out firing your special teams coordinator doesn't absolve you from special teams' lack of execution.
That's just such a...
38-21. 38-22 in time of possession.
Well, and here's the thing. It's not that like it matters. Like, had they beaten Sam Houston State, it's not like we're coming in today like, well, season was fine. Turn around to the season.
Of course not.
But at the same time, it's like, man, like... If this isn't rock bottom, I don't know what
it is. No, this is. I mean, they were three touchdown favorites.
I will say this, though. I think this confirmed, like, there was kind of talk going into last week because Rod Bakey kind of got the ship back on track. Like, hey, is he a real candidate? I think it's kind of proved, like,
no.
He's not a real candidate.
Perfect interim coach. Perfect interim coach.
Correct.
Not a head coach. I mean, Sam Houston was 0-8. 0-8 and three touchdown dogs. And found a way to beat you 21-17. Like, you rack up 474, but 0-for-3 on fourth down. Sam Houston got 8 first downs in the game. And
they weren't even good. Houston was not good, and they won the
game. These are the most frustrating losses if you're Oregon State. That's for sure. Meanwhile, we'll ask some Ryan Harlan about this, too. But you pointed this out, Steven. TJ Houshmandzadeh. Chiming in a little bit. We know where he was making these comments?
This was on the JB show. Jason Brown from Netflix's Last Chance U. He has a podcast show.
Love Jason Brown.
He's a character. But TJ was on this show, and they were talking about the Pac-12 and Oregon State, and he just makes one little line at the end about it.
Pac-12, I got a suit back.
Man, I don't know what they in the pack off, man. I tried to help them. They don't want my help, so I leave it alone.
I tried to help them out. They didn't want my help, so I leave it alone.
He says, I tried to help them out.
Yeah.
They don't want my help, so I leave them alone.
Yeah.
And Canzano's reported that, like, how some of the administrators have kind of gone away from some of the alumni help, stuff of that nature. This doesn't add on. This doesn't help with it. The blueprint, the Bray, not wanting your alumni back to help. This just kind of adds to all the stories and kind of confirms everything that we've been talking about. And
when you lose games like this, it makes that TJ Houshmandzadeh comment. Number one, he would not make that comment probably if they won that game, but maybe he would. I don't know. But it definitely brings it into a more harsh light of like, really? You're turning down help from people that helped your program at all? I don't know what kind of help TJ could provide. Maybe it was NIL stuff. Maybe it was coaching stuff. I don't know. Maybe he offered to be on the hiring committee, right? That Brandon Cooks is on. And they said, yeah, no, thank you. So who knows what kind of help he offered or if it would have been impactful. But turning down anybody's help at this point does make Oregon State look bad when you're losing to an 0-8 Sam Houston State. Ryan Harlan on 3 Sports joins us for a few minutes coming up on the other side. Plus, we'll have the 5-5 as well, taking you up to Packers-Eagles on Monday Night Football in Portland on 750 The Game. Judah Dubey, Stephen Vaughn in for Kanzano.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Kanzano on 750 The Game.
Side right now, they have allowed an average of 41 points a game this season. They've traveled all the way out here to Oregon, and the home team only has 17 on them. If they're on the Sam Houston side, you're thinking, this has to be our night. Whoa, they block it. There they go. The block, the scoop, and this is going to be a score, and Sam Houston will have the lead.
Not a good Saturday night in Corvallis, and continues to swirl around the coaching search, the state of the union down at OSU, etc. Ryan Harlan covers the team, Beaver's Edge of On3 Sports, and he joins us now. Ryan, where do you want to start with that Saturday night loss as a 3-touchdown favorite at home?
Oh, I mean, like, you could start anywhere, right? Like, you guys, you know, mentioning about the stats and all that stuff. The fact that you outgained an opponent and held them under 160 yards, Oregon State, Judah, since 1996, was 24-0 before this game. They are now 24-1 when they hold opponents under 160 yards. Like, it was truly the most, you know, sickos committee game that you could have ever have watched. I mean, just looking at everything from this game, you outgained a Sam Houston team that was allowing over 500 yards of offense, 41 points a game, and you could only muster up 17, and you outgained them in every statistical category. I mean, it's the perfect microcosm of what this season has been. Like, I mean, special teams miscues, you know, that's just more of a, like, of course, when you have two games early on that you, when AT took over, where, like, they weren't, you know, quite as bad. They were pretty manageable in, you know, Lafayette and then Washington State. But, yeah, just overall, I think a game where, you know, if you're Oregon State, you just kind of burn the tape and you move on the next week and go on to Tulsa.
That's the problem, Ryan. It's like, even if they were to win this game, it's not like it matters. It didn't save the season, but you're right. It's like watching that loss was just pitiful. I want to ask you, like, looking at this team, and, you know, they spent $1.5 million on Malik Murphy. That has not worked out. Jabari Johnson has done some things, but I don't know if he's the answer. Like, is there anything from this roster that is, like, good enough to carry on to next season? Like, you can say, okay, well, this is where they were good enough. This is what they did well. We can carry that into next season. Or is it kind of a whole situation where they're going to need to hire a new coach and just start completely over?
I think you start completely over, and especially at the quarterback position. I don't think the future quarterback of the roster is currently on this 2025 roster for Oregon State going forward. I mean, Malik was going to be a one-year rental, in my opinion. I still stand by that, even now. Jabari Johnson, yeah, has kind of done you some things a little bit, but I don't think he's also the guy either at the same time. But also too, like, you have a new staff coming in, right? I think you're going to have a different sort of roster, mostly of, like, guys that, you know, end up leaving. I think you have some guys that maybe stay a little bit that haven't really seen a lot of playing time this year, but I think it's a blank slate, to be quite honest, coming into next year. But just because, like, it's just one of those kind of seasons where I think everybody's kind of looking on to, you know, the end of the year and turning the page to 2026.
Well, and looking to that, like, what, talk about the coaching search a little bit, because we've heard some names. Canzano's kind of shot down some names, you know, the big one, Ed Orgeron. Like, Canzano's kind of shot that one down. Like, that's not a real thing. Like, who are you looking at to be a replacement? Who are the kind of the fans that you talk to looking at to be maybe the next Oregon State head football coach?
Yeah, I never thought Coach Cho really had a lot of legs to it to begin with. But in terms of kind of what I've been hearing through the grapevine, is Tosh Lapoy has kind of picked up a little bit of steam. Oregon's defensive coordinator, like, I have heard from those around the program that he has expressed interest in the Oregon State job. I've also heard Jamarcus Shepard has picked up some steam as well, too. I've heard some scuttle on Jim Mora, but I think that's just more of, you know, kind of, you hear things as the coaching search goes on of guys that could be potentially interested. And then obviously Paul Christ, I've heard a significant amount on that, but nothing really kind of definitive as who's a clear leader in the clubhouse as of right now, who's the leading guy. But just definitely a lot of different names, you know, kind of the ebbs and flows of, you know, who you hear interested in, who might take this job. And to be quite honest, I'm like, I don't know who's a perfect fit for this job. I do not trust Scott Barnes to make the right call in terms of getting a guy to hit the ground running and make you competitive in year one in the Pac-12. And that's more of a, the stakes are really high to nail this hire. And there's more, I think, of an onus now, even more so kind of coming off of this same Houston loss where it's a, you got to hit the ground running. If you're Oregon State, if you truly think you can compete in the Pac-12 right away in year one in 2026 of this newly rebuilt Pac-12, if you think you're at the top of it.
Scott Barnes is an interesting angle to all of this. You know, he's gotten the university through a lot of things. He's been through a lot of things himself personally. He's been there quite some time. But I do agree with you that for the moment right now, it's, you know, the skepticism is warranted whether or not, you know, he can be the one to make the right call on this. Is there another shoe to drop with all this over the next few weeks before we get to the new year? Or is from a athletic department standpoint, Ryan, or is Scott Barnes, do you think, still there for the long haul enough to where, you know, he's not going to be fired or let go, so he's going to be the one making this call? Or does any part of you foresee, you know, another shoe to drop as it relates to who the people making this hire could be?
I mean, with another shoe to drop, it feels like there could be one. It's kind of how I think this entire year has panned out with kind of everything blueprint sports related. It always seemed to be like something new was always going to come out. So I don't want to rule out the possibility of that. But I think for the long term, I think Scott Barnes is still there. Ultimately, it's Murphy's call. And kind of knowing her background, mostly in academics, she defers to Scott on a lot of things. And I think if there were a point where, you know, the seat gets really, really hot for Barnes, I think Murphy would have to make that call. But ultimately, it's just, I think you kind of have to see how things play out the rest of the year. And I think Barnes is making that hire, you know, when we get to that new coach press conference around December, end of November.
Ryan Harlan, he's at Ryan_Harlan7, covers the Beavs for Beaver's Edge of On3 Sports. Thanks for popping on with us, Ryan. We appreciate it.
Yeah, no, of course. Appreciate you guys having me on. Thank you.
Some questions for the Beavs, to say the least, coming down the home stretch, Steven. And look, at the end of the day, Giathi Murthy probably isn't going to make a move on Scott Barnes or other athletic department leadership at this time, post Brent Blaylock move already in the rear view. But it's a tough time, I think, to be a Beaver fan, to be optimistic about anything going forward as it relates to football right now.
Yeah, I mean, how can you be optimistic? You really can't be, just with how the season's gone. And there were some, not like there were a ton of expectations, but we had people on saying, look, you know, things go right. 10 wins for the Beavs this year. 9 wins. Well, they're going to go two wins, maybe 3 wins if you're lucky. So
their favorite at Tulsa.
I'll take Tulsa. But I mean,
I can't believe that's a real sentence.
I know, right? But I can't believe I said that they lost to Sam Houston State. But that's the thing. You can't, right? How can you trust Scott Barnes to make the right choice right now? You just can't. And so you have to put your blind faith in it and say, look, he's made a couple right decisions before, right? Like, he's hired Canham. You know, he's done some positive things. Let's hope he can figure it out for one more time for Beaver football going into 2026.
One time.
The new Pac-12. One time, baby. Come on.
One time. Two games to go for the Beavs. At Tulsa, then a bye week, and then at Wazoo to close up shop on 2025. 5 and 5 is coming up next. We'll rip through that and set the table for Packers-Eagles Monday Night Football here on 750 The Game in Portland. Judah Newby, Stephen Vaughn in for John Canzano here on the Bald-Faced Truth.
BFFT. Now, built by High Caliber Millwrights, in for John Canzano, here's Judah Newby and Stephen Vaughn with the Bald-Faced Truth.
Been a fun show so far. You can find the podcast if you missed any part of it. Spencer McLaughlin, Locked On College Football and Locked On Ducks, talked Ducks Iowa with us. Then Ryan Harlan of On3 Sports did the same. Judah Newby, Stephen Vaughn in for John Canzano. Ryan joining us moments ago to touch on the Beavs loss to Sam Houston and where we're at with the coaching search. Best of luck to the Beavs. Woo. They got some stuff to figure out.
That's really all you can say is good luck.
Good luck. Come on now.
Come on now.
Let's put a pelt on the wall. You know, one time for the good folks down there. One time. At least you got that win over Wazoo. That was nice.
Pac-12 champs.
Pac-12 champs for now. Before they got another one. For the Ducks, Steven says this is the most impressive win. The most impressive win of Dan Lanning's tenure as Oregon Duck head coach. I, in turn, think that win took so much guts, strength, depth. The rushing game was fantastic, and yet there's still enough there that leaves me worried about Oregon's chances to actually win the championship this year. I think they're a good team, they're a playoff team, but they're not a national championship team. And if that's the case, then what does that mean for the team at large? Like, the big picture that they're going for to be a national title winning team. Probably more accurate for the 2026 version of Oregon than the 2025, but that was a big, big win for the 2025 version of the Oregon Ducks. We've got the 5-5 coming up. We got Packers-Eagles at 5:15. Steven, let's hit it. Let's rip through five big things going on in the world of sports.
The 5-5. Number one.
Well, there's been a lot of news about gambling and sports in Major League Baseball. Of course, they are now a part of it. Now, this is coming off of Cleveland Guardians pitcher Luis Ortiz and Emmanuel Clase. So they were supposedly throwing balls. And then on DraftKings and in these sports books, you can bet on individual pitches. Will it be a ball? Will it be a strike? Will it be swung at? How fast the pitch is going? Well, according to people, they were, you know, they had their friends be betting on that they're going to throw a ball on this pitch, and they would. So prominent U.S. sports books are now establishing a nationwide $200 betting limit on baseball wagers centered around individual pitches and are prohibiting these bets from being included in parlays in an attempt to decrease the incentive for manipulation. The biggest sports books will limit it to the prop bets $200, balls and strikes, over-under velocities, and they won't be parlayed. Rob Manfred said, I commend the industry for working with us to take action on a national solution to address the risks posed by these pitch-level markets, which are particularly vulnerable to integrity concerns. I think this is the right choice. You know, if you're betting thousands on balls and strikes, I feel like you got some inside information on that. Those are kind of bets that it's so random in that situation. Prohibit those at $200 bets. I feel like it will kind of weed out some of the people that are going to do it for shady reasons. So I commend the sports books for allowing that because they're not going to be making as much money. I commend Major League Baseball for taking advantage of it. They don't want to be caught in the whole NBA Portland Trailblazers Chauncey Billups situation. So I think kind of good on everybody that they're going to limit these bets.
Yeah, Luis Ortiz arrested Sunday in the Boston Logan Airport and posted $500,000 bail. And
that's just a couple strikes thrown, though.
Yeah, Class A, it looks like he is out of the country. So we'll see.
The funniest part about this is a Class A, they actually lost one of their bets that they were, you know, trying to rig. So Class A was facing Andy Páez of the Dodgers, who was terrible in the postseason. So everyone was making fun of him. Class A threw one in the dirt. Páez swung at the ball. And so it was actually called a strike rather than a ball. And his guys texted him after the game like, dude, what the heck, man? He's like, yeah, sorry, I can't control that type of
thing. Yeah, that's crazy. Páez, hey, man, one of the biggest catches in World Series history now.
Mowed him over.
Unbelievable.
Number two.
We got some NFL news today. Bengals, they announced that they're going to start their 21-day period of limited practice with Joe Burrow. So hopefully Joe Burrow can come back within that 21-day period and come off injured reserves. Now, the Bengals have upcoming games against the Steelers, the Patriots, and Ravens, so they got a tough schedule coming forward. The Burrow was non-committal today about a return date, but he said he would like to come back for the Thanksgiving Day game against the Baltimore Ravens. So that's a couple weeks from now, a week and a half. Bengals are 3-6 on the season, two games out from the Steelers. Joe Flacco did win that Monday night game, but hasn't been great since then. I mean, if you're the Bengals, are you really just going to risk throw Joe Burrow out there? You can't play safety, can't play cornerback, can't stop anybody. Like, I mean, I kind of feel like, what's the point at this point? But also, you got Joe Burrow on your roster. You got to sell some tickets. You want to get to put up some points. If you're going to make the playoffs, it's with Joe Burrow. So we'll see. But Joe Burrow has been activated, and 21-day period starts today.
That's crazy. Number one, 21. I mean, it's November 10th, and 21 days, you know, doesn't that get you past Thanksgiving? Minimum. You can activate it. 21, you have to come off, you know, unable to perform within 21 days.
Right, Thanksgiving is 17 days from now.
Okay. That's interesting to me. Look, it's a tough schedule for they can't make a playoff run at this point. Burrow is such a competitor. I know he wants to beat the Ravens.
You don't think if they can split the Steelers and Patriots, go 4-7, Joe Burrow comes back, they can run off 6 straight?
No. The defense, to your point. Yeah. That's
devil's out of the game. Yeah,
well,
agree.
You know, they tried to do the same thing last year and came really close, right. But Burrow got back earlier last year than this. They didn't have as much of a hill to climb, it seemed, at that time. So, you know.
Zach Taylor fired?
I think he's done probably at the end of the... Well, who knows with Bengals ownership. I think he's probably done at the end of the year one way or the other.
Number three.
Maybe gets fired and takes over the New York Giants job as Brian Daboll of the Giants was fired today by the New York Giants as their head coach. Giants 2-8 on the season, but they do have some things. Jackson Dartz looked really good as a rookie out of Ole Miss. Cam Scadaboo, of course, out for the season, but he looked good when he played. They got Malik Nabers. He's been out, but they've been competitive in games. They've lost a lot of fourth quarter leads. So Brian Daboll out as 2-8 on this season. I mean, I think the question would be, like, do you just hang on to him the rest of the season or fire him now? I don't think there's a problem either way, but Daboll out. I think that'll be this will be a job that people will want because of Jackson Dart, the way he plays. But, man, that guy plays like a maniac. He gets concussions, it seems like, every single game. So you got to rein him back in. But not a terrible job for the New York Giants.
Yeah, I don't think Jackson Dart's going to be a long-haul NFL quarterback for that very reason. The volatility is too much. He's very exciting, but he's very up and down, and up and down doesn't get you that far in the NFL. So unless it takes a special offensive coordinator to come in and calm him down and make that more of a sustainable operation, that it's got to be an offensive-minded head coach. The tough part with that is you just had one in Daboll, and obviously they went 11-33 after they went to the playoffs. Not entirely sure I trust John Mara company to make the right call, but Joe Shane is still the general manager. He keeps his job in all of this. Mike Kafka might end up getting the job. He's the interim OC, and he's been floated around in head coaching searches before. You know, the Seahawks have tried to hire Kafka as offensive coordinator numerous times, and the Giants have blocked them from doing it. Well-respected guy with Chiefs ties, so he may be the one getting it in the end, but we'll see how it goes for Big Blue.
Number four.
Joe Shane has a little Neil O'Shea to him. Just kind of survive. Everything goes down. You're the cockroach that's left. Well, number four, I just want to talk about the Seahawks because I know you love them and it makes you excited. Seahawks got the win over the Cardinals 44-22 yesterday on Sunday. Seahawks are now 7-2 on the season and tied with the Rams for the number one seed in the NFL. They look really good, Judah. I know you are watching them. You're loving them. How are you feeling about your Seattle Seahawks after their win against the Cardinals and, tied with the Rams? Number one seed in the NFC.
Yeah, Rams this week, 7-2 Seahawks, 7-2 Rams down in L.A. That's a huge game. Played them again on Thursday Night Football in December later in the year. I love this team. There's so much to like about them. Offensively, getting off to such fast starts. Their first 15 is dialed in. Sam is so accurate. You don't even have to run the ball that well in order for the run game and play action game to be effective. And Smith and Jigba is darn near uncoverable. The one thing for me is injuries. You know, Ernest Jones missed this game. So did Josh Jobe. So did Torrey Horton. Didn't matter because it's the Cardinals and you got off to a fast start, but eventually it will matter, especially Ernest Jones at middle linebacker. So need him back, need him healthy, but they're deep. They have the belief of the coach. Great alignment there. The offense is dialed in. Hopefully they don't peak too soon. And hopefully 13-4 is enough to win the NFC West because that's the record in my head that is what it's going to take to get it done.
Number five.
And we're heading out a little early today because of Monday Night Football. Eagles at Packers, big-time game with two big-time teams going at it in the NFC. Right now, currently, a true pick'em. Both teams minus two teams, both minus 110 on the money line.
Money on Philly. Late.
So who are you liking this one, the Eagles or Packers? I'll take the Pack.
I also take the Packers. I was thinking you might go Philly. I think Philly is the better team. This is more of a spot play, though, for me.
Bounce back for the bounce Packers back after
from,
the loss.
Yeah, bounce back from Carolina for sure. The Tucker Kraft injury, maybe that's just too much for them to overcome. But I think Green Bay's defense is able to respond tonight against Philly. But we'll see. We've countered Philly out before, and they've come out and dominated. But I will take the Packers to win this game and get back on the right track tonight. You got Green Bay as well. So
I do, yeah.
There you go. Didn't get to everything on the show today, but of course, John will be back tomorrow, 3 to 6 p.m. for a full Tuesday show. For Stephen Vaughn, I'm Judah Newby. If you missed any part of the show, you can find it on the podcast. Thanks to Spencer McLaughlin and Ryan Harlan for joining us earlier. This has been The Bald-Faced Truth.